Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. This is A.B. Dawji, and this is, of course, the big picture. The big picture. So, hey, all you people are looking nice and healthy, eh? Went to town during iftar time, didn't you, eh? Okay, lots to cover today. But first, let me ask you this. Who do you think will win the Comrades Marathon? Who do you think will win the Comrades Marathon? Will it be Ace or Cyril? But you're a little confused there, didn't I? Yes, there's a race going on between the comrades. Ace Magashule or our man Cyril Amaposi. Well, the former is trying to assert himself, eh? That is Ace, trying to appear to be the dominant voice, the main O. And Mr. Tumamina is battling to steer the ship to a new dawn. Immediately after the election results came out, Fikile Mbalula said it was better that Cyril was the president because the ANC didn't do so badly as opposed to if Nkosazana Zuma was the president. Well, Ace came out saying it got nothing to do with just one man, meaning Cyril, of course. It was the work of the collective, meaning the whole ANC that brought the votes in. Wonderful stuff, isn't it? And a few days ago, Ace decided not to consult the so-called collective and made a statement on his own, independently saying that, well, some changes should be made to the Reserve Bank. The RAND already weakened by the news a few days before that the economy had shrunk by nearly 3%, then took a hell of a dive. Well, some ANC heavyweights came out and basically said that Ace was talking sheer nonsense. So, who is going to win the Comrades Marathon, this Comrades Race? Okay, let's leave that. Today, I'm not in the mood to discuss international politics. That may be a little later in the program. Right now, I want to get something off my chest. It's been troubling me for some time. The feeling is like when you had a third helping of biryani and guzzled four glasses of Coke, and the whole thing is sitting on your chati with the masoor threatening to fire off some grenades. Well, it's something like that. Something that's been irritating me for some time. And I was wondering if I should actually bring up the issue, share it with you. Because you know what happens when you tackle a sensitive issue, then people, they get the wrong end of the stick. And then the Rottweilers, the radio jihadists come out to bite your heads off. So let me say this. I raise the issue as an open question, meaning perhaps I'm wrong. Maybe I'm hopelessly wrong. And someone may have the right answer. You see, I'm already getting nervous and trying to keep my back covered. Ah, what the heck. Let me mix my metaphors and put my head in the lion's mouth and cross the crocodile-infested river. Hey, man, I lived through George Bush's bombardment of Baghdad, so I can easily withstand a few WhatsApp Scud missiles, eh? Okay, here goes. Let me first extend the suspense a little bit more with the preamble. I'm sure that when you were driving along a highway at some time, you must have come across a big sign saying, "Thank you for not speeding." Well, I can imagine somebody saying, "Hell, so nice for them to know that I was driving within the speed limit." Or would a lighty in a souped-up Golf GTI says, "Yeah, yeah, 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 they thank me for nothing. I was doing 160 kilometers an hour." Well, the point is that there is no real point to that sign. No one really appreciates it because it's impersonal. Just a blanket thank you, words on a board. So what about when you call a company and are made to hold on and hold on, and then a voice comes on, your call is important to us. You know, I'm tempted to say, you moron, if it were so important, you would have got hired more people to answer phones instead of making me hold on for 25 minutes. And anyway, how do you know that what I'm going to tell you is important? Maybe I called to say that I want to close my account because you're a bunch of nincompoops. Well, the bottom line is this. I hate empty, emotionless, insincere, impersonal messages. Which brings me to the point. At last I hear you say, well, remember the old days? I'm talking about way, way back. I'm only about 45 years old. Anyway, way, way back when you received letters in the post, in the mail, at either your post office or delivered to your door. Well, around this time, Eid time, during those days, you received Eid cards in the mail addressed directly to you from someone that you know. A nice card saying to A.B. Dawji and family, Eid Mubarak from Imran, Manak, or somebody like that. It made me feel so nice. It was personal, from him to you. Wonderful. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the internet, and more especially social media, had completely changed the communications landscape. Oh, I like the way I put that one. Internet, and more especially social media, has completely changed the communications landscape. Social media can be wonderful at times. Breaking news can spread at lightning speed. And you know, once upon a time, when the word viral came up, your mother rubbed Vicks on your chest. Well, incidentally, the one I hate most is the one that says, forwarded as received. That is like saying, look, I don't know if the story is true. I don't know whether it's true or not. I'm just sending it to you anyway. Well, listen, you irresponsible donkey. What if the story is not true? Then you will be guilty of spreading lies. Isn't that so? I received so many such stories, and a 30-second Google check would reveal that these stories are fake. Most of them anyway. Especially if they're outrageous. So why can't people do this instead? Google it. Instead of doing the lazy thing with a disclaimer, forwarded as received. So, as I was saying, it was great to receive an Eid card with your name on it. But this is where social media is a real pain in the neck. You know, over the past week or so, I have been subjected to a tsunami of Eid cards on WhatsApp. A deluge, a flood. Cute cards, colorful cards, cards with music or nasheed, the clips. One with water being poured into a glass, or as we say here in Durban, into a tumbler and all. Hundreds of cards posted on WhatsApp groups or Facebook, or on Facebook in job lots. Wishing you and your family Eid Mubarak. Impersonal, like saying, to whom it may concern, dear sir, madam, happy Eid. It's just like that. What's the difference? What is the point? Putting a card on Facebook, when you wish someone something, you must know who you are directing your feelings towards. You get me? Feelings towards. But what do we have? A competition to see who can post the cutest cards. And the worst is the data gobbling videos where the card opens to release a whole lot of stars and birds and some Arabic lyrics and so on. A simple WhatsApp message, Eid Mubarak, A.B. Dawji from Gulambai. Now that would be worth 1,000 impersonal cute cards. Have I made my point? Eh? Am I wrong? Maybe I'm wrong. Okay, now to part two of getting things off my chest. I'm now going to venture into very dangerous territory, a minefield. Now, since Facebook was born in 2004 and WhatsApp was born in 2009, almost everyone has been lowering their gazes. Well, actually, they've been checking out their phones. You walk in the street and people are looking at their phones, and even when they're driving, they're glancing at the phone, lowering the gazes. But something else was also born, a new way of doing things. Let me ask you this. When you get into your car to drive to work, do you read Subhanallahi sakralana haza wa ma kunna lahu mukrinin wa inna ila rabbina lamunqalibun? Or do you just write it into WhatsApp and then drive off? Well, that may sound like a stupid question, but let me extend that to the question I just asked. Would you read it or would you write it down? Of course, you would make your dua for traveling directly to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Right. Allah is omniscient and omnipresent, all-knowing and everywhere at all times. You say your dua, you verbalize it, speak it out, and then you hope that Allah accepts it. The moment you hear news, now this is it. The moment that you hear news, somebody stops you in the road or somebody phones you, that someone died. When you hear news that someone died, you say out very loudly, Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. You say it, don't you? You acknowledge that we come from Allah and to Him we will return. That's it. For centuries, that is what we said. We said it out. So, when you get a message that someone died, either if someone called you or sent a message on WhatsApp, shouldn't you immediately exclaim loudly, Inna lillahi, and so on, Inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un? Shouldn't you just say it, even if you saw it on WhatsApp? My question is, why post this on WhatsApp? Why do you have to post it? Why do you have to write the whole thing out on WhatsApp? Eh? You are communicating directly with Allah, if you say it. Why post these words on WhatsApp? Make a dua out loudly. Ya Allah, grant the marhum Jannatul Firdaus directly to Allah. Why post it on WhatsApp? Allah hears you straight away. No need to type. Why do people do this? It sort of established itself slowly as an acceptable way of doing things. And I think it's pointless. But maybe I'm wrong. But think about it for a moment, eh? Before you reject what I'm saying. And you have a number of people after that posting the same response. And many others will say, Ameen and Ameen and Ameen, keep posting that. And of course, some people are very trigger happy, fast off the starting line. In the haste to record their response, they get all mixed up. A message comes up, Hussein Khan passed away at Addington Hospital. Mr. Speedy Fingers' response, may he be granted complete shifa. No. Yeah, I don't know. I'm going to walk deeper in the crocodile river. And it's nothing to do with social media. Nothing to do. I'll leave that aside for a minute, right? Although social media demonstrates that once something starts, somebody starts some sort of a trend, then it begins to grow and grow and then becomes an accepted pattern of doing things as I just explained. Now, I have traveled all around the world. Alhamdulillah. Alhamdulillah. But it seems to me that it is a particular idiosyncrasy. Nice word, I checked it up this morning just to impress you. A peculiarity here in South Africa, to use a certain phrase. Right? It happens a lot, and I've only come across it in South Africa, or maybe even in India. You meet someone, have a small chat, and as they leave, they say, remember us in your duas. Sometimes it's just one person standing there telling you this. And you say, remember us in your duas, and you wonder if somebody's hiding behind him. Or maybe you think, remember, as maybe the royal blood that is called, it's called the royal plural, like Queen Elizabeth would say, we are not happy today. That means she is not happy. So, how do you respond to that, eh? When somebody says, remember us in your blood? Do you say, inshallah? Well, let me tell you this. Very often we use the word inshallah very loosely, casually, meaning without thinking deeply about the incredible importance of this expression. Incredible importance of this expression, inshallah. It really means, yes, I intend to do something and pray. I make dua that Allah helps me to achieve it, that Allah breathes life into my action or project and makes it successful. One may call it a holy partnership. But often we use inshallah in a very casual way and sometimes in a disrespectful way. You are a mechanic, for example, and you get a call. Hey, Samad, it's Farooq here. My car won't start. Can you come across to my house and look at it? And you answer, inshallah. You end the call and then you turn to your friend and say, ha, but Farooq, you can go and fly a kite. He still owes me bucks for the last job I did on his car. Eh? And you meet somebody after a long time and you say, hey, now I'm staying in Masjid. Why don't you come and visit me? And you say, inshallah. And then he's gone, then you turn to your friend and you say, that guy, hey, he's a creep and his jokes are so dry. I'd rather go and have a root canal at the dentist than to go and visit him at his house. But you said, inshallah. So often people say, inshallah, and know very well that they don't really mean to do what they promised to do. You are breaking a covenant. Inshallah implies a commitment, a contract. If the brother says, remember us in your dua, how do I answer? If I say inshallah and don't remember him in my dua later that night, did I speak a lie? Is it a sin? And he didn't even give me his name. I just met him casually in the supermarket. I don't even really know him. He didn't give me his name. How will I remember him and mention him? The man with the grey kurta? Look, please get it clear. I'm not mocking anyone. But I just wonder about these things. How things evolve and develop into a pattern as more and more people adopt a certain way of doing things. Let me demonstrate this. First you had, remember me in your duas. Now this has evolved. Someone decided to add, remember us in your pious duas. Now more and more people are saying it in that way, remember us in your pious duas. Hang on, I thought all duas were pious. It's like saying to somebody, hey, can you please pass me the sweet sugar? You see what I mean? Can you see? So, hey, let me just stop right there. Get into serious trouble. Well, there you are. Just a few things that have been occasionally going around in my head. So I thought I'd just ventilate them. And let me emphasize this. I want to emphasize this. No offense intended. So put that talwar back into your belt, okay? And while on the question of prayers, okay, let me just stop there for an ad break. Right, the program is called The Big Picture. And as I was saying, I just ventilated a few things that were going around in my mind. And while on the question of prayers, here's something that really surprised me. You know, way back when I was in Port Shepston Indian Primary School, that's what it was called, we used to have something called assembly every morning. I don't know if it still happens today. The whole school would assemble in the courtyard before going to class. We had to recite the Lord's Prayer. Most of the pupils were either Hindu or Muslims, and perhaps just a handful of Christians at that time. But every morning we had to say the Christian prayer known as the Lord's Prayer. I can still remember parts of it. Our Father who art in heaven. Actually, for a long time, my young mind wondered what kind of art was being done in heaven. No offense meant again, and then nobody explained it to me at that time. Anyway, it says here, Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us, and lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever. Amen. So this is what we had to recite every morning. In later years, when we were in higher grades and more wake up, my chummy is at the back, right, standing right at the back, disrespectfully sang Yellow Submarine while the prayer was recited. Scoundrels, really, scoundrels. Anyway, what's this all about? I hear you say. But this prayer goes back a long time. According to the Church of England, the Lord's Prayer is the prayer Jesus, known to us as Isa alayhi salam, taught his disciples when they asked him to pray. So Christians have been doing this ever since that time for centuries. But this week something remarkable happened. Pope Francis, head of the Catholic Church, was not happy with one line in the prayer, lead us not into temptation. He explained on Italian TV, as reported in the British Guardian newspaper, it is not the great, not the good translation, because it speaks of a God who induces temptation. I am the one who falls. It's not him pushing me into temptation to then see how I have fallen. A father doesn't do that. A father helps you to get up immediately. It's Satan who leads us into temptation. That's his department. That's what the Pope said. So there you are. The original implied that God must stop leading us into temptation. So the new version will say, do not let us fall into temptation. Well, there you are, folks. I thought that may be of some interest to you. As for me, I'll have to make lots of tawbah for all those years in primary school when I wrongfully implied in the prayer that God leads us into temptation, and therefore should please not do so. Mm. Final word. The new wording was approved by the General Assembly of the Episcopal Conference of Italy last month. It will appear in the third edition of the Messale Romano, the liturgical book that contains the guiding text for Mass in the Roman Catholic Church. Right, okay, let's get to weightier matters, heavy subjects. All through the week, the news overseas on TV, BBC, CNN, Al Jazeera, was about two anniversaries. There was almost non-stop coverage on Western channels about something called the Normandy invasion, which took place on the 6th of June, 1944. So it was the 75th anniversary this week. And another anniversary that had quite huge coverage on TV, it was known as the Tiananmen Square Massacre, which took place in the center of Beijing on the 4th of June, 1989. So let's look at these two historic events briefly and see how they relate to what's happening today. On the 6th of June, 1944, 150,000 troops, soldiers from the United States, Canada, and Britain landed on the beaches of France to confront the Germans. That was the turning point of World War II. That was known as D-Day. And this week, all the Western leaders gathered in London to commemorate this event that took place 75 years ago, standing up against Nazi tyranny. Wonderful to see such unity among Western leaders. There were a whole lot of them, I think about 30 or 40. It reminded me of the huge march in France not so long ago, where Western leaders linked arms and marched in a show of solidarity, of unity against the Charlie Hebdo attacks. Remember some Muslims went in and attacked that magazine? The editors and so on of the magazine. Some people were killed. Well, I watched the 75th anniversary of D-Day and I wondered, when will we see all the Muslim leaders of the world coming together in one united front to stand up against the tyranny by mainly the West against Islam and Muslims? There's a question for you. Well, sadly, the reality is that the Muslim leaders are either used to create fighting and division in the Muslim world, or lack a backbone. I wish, with all his faults, more of them could be like Mahathir Mohamad of Malaysia. It really is sad, eh? And when I watched the Western media highlighting the massacre that took place in Tiananmen Square in 1989 by the Chinese military shooting unarmed civilians, mainly students, protesting peacefully in the square for freedom and justice. Perhaps there were thousands of them. Well, hundreds were killed by live fire, and perhaps thousands were injured, and many more wounded. I watched this horror as it was repeated, it was replayed in the media, and also the rally by thousands of people in Hong Kong earlier this week commemorating this massacre, remembering this terrible massacre which took place in 1989. Very sad stuff indeed. But what made me even more sad was that there was another Tiananmen Square massacre. Yes, just a short while ago, a few days ago, that took place, well, it was over the last 2 weeks, in Sudan. Hundreds and hundreds of people were in a sit-in outside a government building, peacefully demonstrating, asking the military regime running the country after President Bashir was booted out by popular protest, asking the military to give the population civilian rule, normal democracy. Well, special forces came in from all directions and began shooting these people who were at the sit-in. It was a horror situation, horrific. Over 100 killed, hundreds more injured, women were raped, 40 bodies were pulled out of the River Nile where they were thrown into. People were horrified. People were horrified at the 1989 Tiananmen Square massacre, but Sudan's Tiananmen Square massacre evoked some very weak words of condemnation. Something like the military should exercise restraint and so on. The African Union, which is responsible for ensuring peace on the continent, took a very big and bold step. It suspended Sudan's membership of the African Union. Wow, eh? Isn't that amazing? What a big blow for Sudan, eh? Membership cancelled. Innocent people are massacred, women raped, hundreds injured. All these people wanted was justice and freedom and democracy. And the African Union suspends Sudan's membership. That's all. Tell us nothing more. It's absolutely sickening. Sickening. And what are the Muslim leaders doing about this? This absolutely horrific situation in Sudan? Don't let me get started on that lot. Ah, yes, right in the middle of these D-Day celebrations, we had our dear friend, President Fadla, being the center of attraction. But he actually behaved himself. He didn't do anything silly or embarrassed his host. He had a Lucky Chow session with the Queen and at a big banquet. It all went off very well, except that he said he didn't really notice that huge crowd demonstrating against his visit. He saw, he said, more American flags welcoming him. I think many in his team were quite relieved that he kept his mouth shut most of the time. And this reminds me of a saying, it's better to keep your mouth shut and have people think that you are a fool than to open it and remove all doubts. And as I told you many times, it still amazes me that in the U.S., with a population of 300 million, the best that people could choose to lead them is this orange-haired Baghdad. But I'll tell you more about him later. I just came across some startling research. Listen to this. Donald Trump has told 4,140 false stories, made 12,538 untrue statements, and proposed 1,177 unfulfilled promises as of late May 2019, according to the research group PolitiFact. The Washington Post announced that Trump reached the unthinkable milestone of 10,000 bogus claims on April 29, 2019. Yet, Trump continues to have 42% popularity ratings, and a Yale economist who predicted that Trump would win in 2016 predicted he will get 56.1% of the popular vote in 2020. And he is not alone in that prediction. So what do you conclude from this, eh? The answer is that Donald J. Trump, of course J means jungly, is a first-class liar. But you know what's a nightmare bit? The nightmare part of this research is at the end. The bit that says that Trump will win again in 2020 by 56% of the vote. Be afraid. Be very afraid. Okay, now let me take out my old record and play it again. The situation in Palestine. Hey, by the way, as you promised in Ramadan, all of you raised your hand and you said you would study the map of Israel and Palestine and the whole region and Iraq and Lebanon where it's located. You promised that in Ramadan with your rosa mouth. So I hope you did that. Now, let me begin by making a bold statement. Are you ready for this? And fasten your seatbelts. I think Netanyahu is doing the right thing. Did you hear that? Did you get that? No, Ramadan is over, but I didn't smoke anything. Bibi is my man. Did ABW just say that Gori Bibi is a man? Get Netanyahu's name, Benjamin, Bibi for short. So, let me explain. He recently said that he is thinking of annexing the whole of the West Bank. Wonderful, wonderful, I say. I would urge him to annex the whole of the Gaza also. At the moment, the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza are governed by Hamas in Gaza and Mahmoud Abbas's crowd in the West Bank. Israel says that it is not responsible for them because they are governed by the old people. Well, just follow me very closely here. If the government of Hamas and Mahmoud Abbas say, okay, we don't want to govern the Palestinians anymore, then Israel will be forced to. We'll have a very big problem, in fact. Full control and responsibility of all the Palestinians in the Gaza and the West Bank will be the duty of Israel. Then how will it apply the law? Will it have one law for all of the people that it is controlling or different ones for Israelis and Palestinians? Aha! But that would be the dreaded word, apartheid. It would be a hot potato for Bibi. I hope Netanyahu would do it. I hope he would take over the whole of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Really, I hope he does that. But would Mahmoud Abbas and his merry men, known as the Palestinian Authority, will they do it? Will they give up power? Not on your Nelly, Mahmoud. No chance. They are enjoying the good life. While the Palestinians are suffering economically, suffering, really suffering, and it's getting bad every day. Listen to this. According to a recent report by the World Bank, unemployment rates in the West Bank stand at 18-19%, increasing to 40% for young people under the age of 30. So, in this terrible situation, guess what happened? I'm reading from a news article. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas approved a 67% pay rise for Palestinian Authority officials, as well as other financial benefits amounting to tens of thousands of dollars, while the West Bank economy struggles and swathes of public sector employees spend months with reduced pay. Newly leaked documents have revealed a series of confidential documents disclosing the pay rises were this week posted to social media and subsequently viewed by the Associated Press, The documents show that in 2017, Abbas approved pay rises for Palestinian officials, that is his government, increasing the monthly salaries from $3,000 to $5,000, and he himself, the Prime Minister's monthly salary, was raised to $6,000. In addition, these pay rises were implemented retroactively, that means going back to 2014, so that increase will be paid from then, added all up and given now. Other financial benefits approved during this period include giving ministers living outside Ramallah, where the government is, $10,000 a year to rent a house in the city. And anyway, these moves were kept secret from the Palestinian public for the past 2 years. So, there you have it. I can't see the Palestinian Authority, that cardboard government of Mahmoud Bai, giving up power and all the wonderful privileges that he and his chumchas enjoy. Now, let me end with my favorite topic, President Pagla. As I said, I really can't understand how he became president, even though he has been there for about 3 years, I think. And he still shows no sign of improving and giving us growing up to be a real world leader. As I always say, you can't make a racehorse out of a donkey. I'm always grappling in trying to describe exactly what Donald Trump is. I just can't find the words. But one man has written brilliantly about Trump. It's about the funniest piece of writing that I've come across for a very long time. It had me laughing and laughing and laughing. So let me read it to you. But actually, it was a question that was asked on a website. Why do British people not like Donald Trump? That was the question. And there's a chap by the name of Nate White, a very articulate and witty writer from England, and he wrote this magnificent response. Listen to this. A few things spring to mind. Trump lacks certain qualities which the British traditionally esteem. For instance, he has no class, no charm, no coolness, no credibility, no compassion, no wit, no warmth, no wisdom, no subtlety, no sensitivity, no self-awareness, no humility, no honor, and no grace. All qualities, funnily enough, with which his predecessor, Mr. Obama, was generously blessed. So, for us, the stark contrast does rather throw Trump's limitations into embarrassingly sharp relief. Plus, we like to laugh, and while Trump may be laughable, he has never once said anything wry, witty, or even faintly amusing. Not once, ever. I don't say that rhetorically, I mean it quite literally. Not once, not ever. And that fact is particularly disturbing to the British sensibility. For us to lack humor is almost inhuman. But with Trump, it's a fact. He doesn't even seem to understand what a joke is. His idea of a joke is a crass comment, an illiterate insult, a causal act of cruelty. Trump is a troll, and like all trolls, he is never funny, he never laughs, he only crows or jeers. And scarily, he doesn't just talk in crude, witless insults, he actually thinks in them. His mind is a simple, bot-like algorithm of petty prejudices and knee-jerk nastiness. There is never any underlayer of irony, complexity, nuance, or depth. It's all surface. Some Americans might see this as refreshingly upfront. Well, we don't. We see it as having no inner world, no soul. And in Britain, we traditionally side with David, not Goliath. All our heroes are plucky underdogs. Robin Hood, Dick Whittington, Oliver Twist. Trump is neither plucky nor an underdog. He is the exact opposite of that. He's not even a spoiled rich boy or a greedy fat cat. He's more a fat white slug. A Jabba the Hutt of privilege. And worse, he is that most unforgivable of all things to the British. A bully. That is, except when he is among bullies. Then he suddenly transforms into a sniveling sidekick instead. There are unspoken rules to this stuff. The Queensberry rules of basic decency. And he breaks them all. He punches downwards, which a gentleman should, would, could never do. Which a gentleman should, would, could never do. And every blow he aims is below the belt. He particularly likes to kick the vulnerable or voiceless, and he kicks them when they are down. So the fact that a significant minority, perhaps a third of Americans, look at what he does, listens to what he says, and then think, yeah, he seems like my kind of guy, is a matter of some confusion, and no less, and no little distress to British people, given that Americans are supposed to be nicer than us, and mostly are. You don't need a particularly keen eye for detail to spot a few flaws in the man. This last point is what especially confuses and dismays British people and many other people too. His faults seem pretty bloody hard to miss. After all, it's impossible to read a single tweet or hear him speak a sentence or two without staring deep into the abyss. He turns being artless into an art form. He is a Picasso of pettiness, a Shakespeare of I can't say the word. His faults are fractal. Even his flaws have flaws. Even his flaws have flaws, and so on, ad infinitum. God knows there have always been stupid people in the world, and plenty of nasty people too. But rarely has stupidity been so nasty or nastiness so stupid. It makes Nixon look trustworthy and George W. Bush look smart. In fact, if Frankenstein decided to make a monster assembled entirely of human flaws, he would make a Trump. And a remorseful doctor, Frankenstein, would cut out big clumpfuls of hair and scream in anguish, "My God, what have I created?" If there was a... Oh, no, I can't read this last part. It's too rude. But I think that was very, very funny indeed. I hope you thought that also. Right, in the minute that we have left, let me just go to the graveyard of light at the end of the tunnel. Now, very quickly, Hari Prasad from Reservoir Hills was in court on as a defense witness. The prosecutor asked him, "Where were you on the 11th of May between 3 and 4 in the afternoon?" And the defense attorney, Mr. Sabir Jazbai, jumped up and objected, "The whereabouts of the witness are immaterial, Your Honor." And he said, I'm happy to answer the question. The prosecutor said, "Okay, I am prepared to repeat the question. Where were you on the 11th of May between 3 and 4 o'clock?" And lawyer Jazbai again protested. He said, "I must protest. The question is irrelevant." Again, Harry said, "I am happy to answer, Your Honor." So the prosecutor said, "I will repeat the question. Where were you on the 11th of January between 3 and 4 in the afternoon?" And Jazbai jumps up again. "I object most strenuously, Your Honor. The answer to that question can have no possible bearing on the outcome of the case." Again, Harry says, "I am happy to answer the question, Your Honor." Now the judge is a bit fed up, and he intervenes, and he says, "The objections of the defense are noted, but the question is a simple one, and whereas I can see no reason why it should be asked, and what possible outcome the answer could have on the proceeding, it appears that the witness is quite happy to answer it. Bearing this in mind, I will allow the prosecutor to ask the question." And so the prosecutor said, thank you, Your Honor. So I repeat, where were you on the 11th of May between 3 and 4 in the afternoon? And Harry, with a big smile on his face, answered, Your Honor, I don't know. This is A.P. Dowdy bidding you all assalamu alaikum and asking you to keep up the Ramadan spirit, inshallah.